Good day, everybody, and welcome to another exciting, fact-filled episode of the Michael and Patty Show, sitting here along the waterfront, Charlottetown. It's high tide, and we've got cruise ships coming in just about every day now in September here. Yesterday, we had two cruise ships, which totaled almost 8,000 people. Good day, Patty. How are things on that side of the beer?
Things are good, and it's been an absolutely beautiful September. It's 2024, just in case someone's listening to this in the future, but it's absolutely beautiful. All the boats are out of the water pretty much, and the birds have now taken up residency on all the piers.
Well, there you go. So in this podcast, we're going to have some fun. We're going to have a discussion, trivia, and Patty's going to tell you an interesting story, because real estate, you just don't want to stay in real estate, and you certainly don't want to be a buyer or seller if it's not fun. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree.
We'll start with a story. The story starts off with Patty being last-minute Patty. Anytime Patty has an appointment, she usually shows up about 12 seconds before whatever time is allocated to it. So in this case, Patty was a little hasty at a doctor's office and took somebody's spot. What happened, Patty?
Well, it said reserved, and I had assumed it was reserved for the patients there. And the only reason why he's saying this is because this turned into a listing appointment. I parked in this parking spot. I went in for my appointment. I came back out, and there was a vehicle parked in front of my vehicle, which meant I could not get out. And it was so wedged in there that I couldn't even sneak out the sides or anything. I was sandwiched in. I had to wait about an hour and a half because I called into the clinic, told them the vehicle, and it turned out it was one of the doctors that I had taken their spot from. Probably about a year later or so, Michael knew of this story, and he knew the doctor's name, or at least not necessarily top of mind, but it all started to come to him. This particular doctor and his wife contacted Michael about listing the property, and it's one of the areas that Michael and I agreed to work in together. And when he told me the name of the clients, for me to get prepared for the appointment, I had informed him that that's who it was. Well, of course, being you found it quite entertaining, and I said, please don't bring it up, because he might not have even have remembered the situation. Well, Michael brought it up, let the client know that, yes, this is, Patty that you're meeting. He goes, I remember her. Yes, she was the one that took my parking spot. I didn't know any of this. I go in, I'm hoping that nothing gets mentioned. And of course, you happen to bring it up at the table, which made for things very awkward and uncomfortable. And I again had to start with my apology. So just know, even if you are just out in your personal business in real estate, we always have to be careful. Probably shouldn't have parked in the spot, so that is my mistake. But talk about an awkward moment, and I'm sure you enjoyed every second of watching me squirm at that table.
I did, because it wasn't awkward for us at all. Actually, the doctor and I found it quite entertaining and humorous.
No, it was not.
So you've learned your lesson.
Don't park in reserved parking spots, because these people, or even upset anyone, because they could end up being a client of yours or potentially become a client of yours.
Well, especially in PEI, as we've discussed, it's just like living in a small town. So you really have to watch what you're doing, and I hope you've learned your parking lesson. Moving on, we're going to get into a couple trivia questions, which I thought of in the last week. We're going to cover some tools at the end of this, because we do know there's real estate agents listening to this podcast, because they have commented. So we're going to cover the tools that the real estate agents should have on hand, which will also be great for buyers and sellers to know the technology behind the real estate agent and the education they have to get to use these tools. So I have a couple trivia questions for you, Patty. The first one is, what does a sold sign mean? You see a sold sign go on a property. What does that mean?
Typically, it means it's no longer available for sale, is what how I would answer that question. It is sold.
The way I would answer that question is, a sold sign only goes up on the property once all the conditions are removed from the contract. So is a property sold that has an offer that comes in that's accepted, but it's subject to a building permit, septic tank inspection, water test, home inspection, insurance inspection? Do I get a sold sign at that point?
No, you do not.
Well, then you would be incorrect. A sold sign is a firmed up deal. So the chances of that deal falling at that point on a percentile basis would be what, in your guess?
I typically have about one every couple years that do not close.
It's so very slim, one percent or less probably, I'm guessing. Next question. What does it mean when I'm driving around town and I see a new price sign?
New price sign means it was overpriced in the beginning, is what how I interpret and read those.
What they should do is change that to adjusted to market price.
Yes. Okay, so my question to you on that is, why do agents use new price signs on their signs if it sends a bad, if those who are aware and those who are listening to this podcast will know now if it sends off that message?
Because the owners probably know the price was too high to begin with, and now they want to alert drivers by, and also these new prices, price reduced, are also listed on our hot sheets and everywhere else on websites. So it just allows people that passed it by at one price to revisit it at the new price.
In the seller's defense, though, maybe they were advised that this was the price, and then their agent ended up saying, you know what, we'll reduce the price and we'll put a new price to get it all, you know, the consumers or your neighbors and people that drive by all excited and want to look into it. So just know that there's different ways you can spin it, but really at the end of the day, it was overpriced.
And it's a marketing tool at this point to get people back to the property to look at it once again. Solar panels have become a topic in Canada and probably in the States. For what reason?
Are you talking about the insurance?
Yes. Insurance companies are getting reluctant to insure houses that have solar panels because of the inherent liability, may that be the expense to replace them when they blow away, crack, whatever, malfunction, or cause an electrical fire. So the insurance companies, and this is a story from Toronto, are now looking at these as a liability issue, and they're having a hard time to find insurance, if they even can. Now, I haven't heard about this in PEI yet, but insurance companies seem to follow each other's actions, so I wouldn't be surprised if this is coming here soon. So it's probably something you want to be aware of if you're going to plaster a bunch of solar panels all over your roof.
Yeah, do your research first. Talk to your insurance company. The article that we were referring to ended up stating that because they were receiving money back as a result of the solar panel energy ended up creating, turned the house into a commercial business because they were drawing an income, which I thought that's a bit of a stretch, but these are the angles that the insurance companies, and like you said, currently Ontario, have taken a position on.
Moving along, you listed a subdivision, and this has happened a number of times with both Patty and I, where you list a subdivision, you have someone that's developing it, which probably isn't a developer. Maybe this is the first subdivision he or she has done. And they really don't understand that there is a number of ramifications behind designing a subdivision that you should be aware of and should have available to your listing agent prior to listing it. That way you're not stuck in analysis paralysis if an offer ever comes in. Some of those things that you want to consider is, number one, if you're going to have restrictive and protective covenants, make sure you have those developed before you start talking to an agent. Those are a list of things you can and cannot do on the land. Most of them are boilerplate. Most of them are stolen from other subdivisions and edited. But you should have those, because when someone purchases that lot or building lots, that will be registered with the deed and come with that lot moving forward, unless it's an error and they've forgotten about them, which has happened from time to time.
Yes, and the covenants are important because once you start selling lots within this newly developed subdivision, they do become the law of the land. And in order to make any changes, there was one subdivision that the developer had a rapport with a home hardware, like a hardware store is what it was. And the supplies were to come from that hardware store, the building supplies, that is. And not thinking long term, 20 years later, that store didn't exist and the covenants. We had to get everyone to sign off on the subdivision, which it never ended up happening. So be careful on what covenants you do put in place and make sure they're realistic and they can last.
Was that Greenwich?
Yes, that was Greenwich.
Yeah, there's a few of them out there. I know some actually in Charlottetown where they've got that in the covenants. They have to buy from a certain supplier because the supplier is the one that developed the subdivision. Other things to consider yourself with, and Patty and I are not going to discuss the applicability, you should talk to your accountant as to whether or not the 15% in PEI HST applies to the purchase price of a lot if you're developing. That's something you want to know now before you put it on the market. Wouldn't you agree?
100%. Now, there is an HST inquiry number, but please know that's just to give you, based on, it's like a pick your own adventure. Is it this? Is it that? Yes, no.
Talk to your accountant.
Yeah. At the end of the day, you should speak to your accountant. Just know that your agent might say, just call the HST inquiry number. It is not going to give you a definitive answer. At the end of the day, you want an official ruling from CRA.
And even if they do give you a definitive answer, they don't work for you. Your accountant works for you.
No, they usually end the call saying, no, this isn't a definitive answer. Based on your answers that you provided today, this, in my opinion, to the best of my opinion, would indicate there is tax or there is not tax. However, you do need to get an official ruling. So they do make sure they protect themselves.
And obviously, if you're a business person, you know about ITCs or input tax credits, and you may get your HST back, or it may more likely be waived at conveyance when you purchase the lot. Again, your accountant can cover that for you. Capital gains. So I'm a developer and I just developed a 20-lot subdivision. Should I just go out willy-nilly and sell all of them in 2 days?
Probably not.
Unless I like to spend lots of money on income tax. So there is a certain threshold and there's certain tiers, both with personal income tax and corporations, that you may want to pay attention to because selling too many lots may cost you too much in capital gains if you don't have a plan. And the other thing is, conceivably, these lots will go up in price as the years go on. So you may want to just consider selling maybe 1, 2 lots, 3 lots a year, but not sell all of them because you may be handing a lot of that money over to the federal government in the form of income tax.
Yes, and yeah, absolutely.
Another situation that scares me, and you're seeing more and more of this since we're now in post-Fiona territory, is people are buying lots, and you incurred this issue within the last week, where the subdivision was developed. It was all called Category 1, which is the perfect soil type for a septic system. They ended up applying for a building permit. They tested it, and it came back Category 4, which is really, really bad. Category 1 or 2 is good. 3, you need an engineered system. 4 is run as fast as you can in the opposite direction. But what concerns me is, you know, you could buy a lot to someone calls pre-approved, go to build on it 3 or 4 or 10 years from now and find out you can't do anything with it because the regulations have changed. So it's something you might want to consider, particularly in smaller lots where there's not a lot of room to move when you're placing your well and septic if that's required.
Yeah, and another thing just to take note of, especially if you have a few acres, now this particular one, it was nothing to do with the drainage or it being wetland, it was the type of soil which ended up triggering this particular property to come in as a Cat 4. So the survey that had the Category 1 results on it was taken after 2000. So we're not talking about, you know, surveys and perk testings that were done back in the 70s or 80s. Or even 90s. These were done since, you know, the 2000s, and it still ended up going from, you know, a Cat 1 down to a Cat 4.
And we did an entire episode covering septic systems, so you may want to refer to that if you're thinking about buying raw land in PEI, and there's not a community sewage or water system.
All I would say just to end that would be typically what we would like to see a current perk test would be something under 2 years. But I wouldn't be getting my client to do a perk test if it takes me a couple years to sell the property and then the buyer's going to end up having to do it one anyways. Would you tell a buyer client to do or your seller client, sorry, to do a perk test on a property before they list?
Would I tell them to do a perk test before they list? I think any information you have is good to have, and complete transparency is always good. But from the purchaser's side, you want to see if you can use that perk test and apply for a building permit, which last time I checked, they were good for 2 years. You were saying they've cut back to one or something? I don't know.
Building permits, the approval. But yeah, just something to take note, have a conversation with your agent and even perhaps the province.
The challenge with doing a perk test, if it's a quarter acre lot, it's a no-brainer because you only put your septic system probably in one place. When you're dealing with 20, 30 acres, I would say don't bother doing a perk test because you could be building anywhere on that land. You know, especially if it's really good property, you don't know where that homeowner or that purchaser is going to put their home. Next, staging your house for sale. We won't beat this subject to death, but I have a house that's owned by some hoarders, and their idea of staging, they've gone through it two or three times, probably removed two truckloads of stuff. And they want it re-photographed, and they went through again, and it still could probably use another truckload of stuff removed. The moral of the story is don't have homeowners stage their house unless they have an assistant that is in the business of staging homes, or they have a real estate agent that's trained in staging homes, because their idea of staged and my idea of staged are two different things. In this particular case, one of the things that's troublesome to me is every room has throws over it. So you go into the living room, they've got blankets on the couches, they got blankets on the love seat. The other thing is all the windows are covered with two and three layers of window coverings, which makes everything dark and dingy. Everywhere you walk, there's floor mats, like all this stuff. The windows need to be, the blinds need to be open, the floor mats need to be removed, the coverings need to be gone. You want it to be nice and open and fresh and sunlight and airy, but not to the point of science lab level.
Now, I agree. Now, would you be opposed? I'm curious your opinion. You have a house that has a perhaps hoarder-like look. Would you virtually stage, because there are some really cool programs now that allow you to remove all the contents and then either have it show it empty or...
No, furniture? I would not, because people are going to want to go through that house in person or virtually, and they're going to say, hey, this looks nothing like these computer and AI generated photos.
Yes, no, I agree. I would probably recommend they put what it looks like and what it could potentially, with a disclaimer that it is a virtually staged, just in case a buyer has a hard time visualizing the space with all this stuff in it, because sometimes it's just not an option to get it all out.
You can do that, and that's a good idea, as long as the photos are marked, these are digitally produced, because our MLS rules are that we have to have an accurate representation of the property, which makes perfect sense. You had another property where the owner claimed there was electrical on site. And when we spent hours walking this property before we brought a vehicle down, we noticed that it had electrical like boxes where you could put meters, and it had a post, and they're mounted in the ground. And I said to Patty, I said, well, where's the electrical? Are they running it underground? Underground electrical's very expensive in PEI because of the procedure that the government wants you to go through in order to install underground electrical. So the answer was no, and there was no electrical. There is just an 8x8 post with a connection where you can mount a meter, but there's no physical electrical lines leading to anything.
Moral of that story is, even if I were to have asked a few different ways, my seller was adamant that this property had electrical in place. Make sure as a listing agent you go out to the property to verify and confirm for yourself, which obviously I had done, and was able to make sure that my representation of this property was accurate in its offerings to the public. However, yes, they did not actually have electrical there. It was just some wooden stakes.
The electrical was located a few miles away, which again, we walked this property and discovered that. The other interesting thing I found about this property is the owner went out of his way to indicate on the survey where the electrical easements are. So an easement is an area which typically looks like a laneway, a thin laneway that allows utility companies to access telephone, electrical, cable TV, whatever, fiber op. So in this particular case, they had indicated on the survey where the easements were, which I thought was a good idea on one hand, but then on the other hand, I'm thinking, well, what if I was going to run my electrical somewhere else? So I want to provide an easement to them. Now I'd have to modify the survey and or whatever's registered to the deed. When you subdivide property or you have a house that electrical lines traverse over the land, you need to contact Maritime Electric, and they will typically draw up something that's going to be affixed or part of the deed that will allow them legal access to those power lines.
I agree.
And for the most part in PEI, power is supplied above ground, unless they spend a lot of money putting it underground. What's the most powerful negotiating tool we can use?
Time.
And you had something that was really funny that happened, and I'm still laughing about it now, where Patty received an offer, and the vendor just wanted to take some time to think about it. And then what happened with the purchaser and the purchaser's agent? Well, you were waiting to hear a response from the vendor.
Well, how it played out was an offer came in, and then my client wasn't available actually for a period of time. They had appointments and that. And then they had said, well, I'm not interested in accepting that offer. And I said, well, you know, we could counter, which typically a good negotiator will try to continue the conversation going, and even if it's just a minimal amount. However, because it timed out, which is part of the frustration that I have with agents not understanding, just because an offer times out, that means that that buyer is not committed to that price any longer. We can counter at any time. We can counter days, weeks, you know, months after and reference that contract agreement. Well, this agent felt that because the offer had timed out, he wanted a new offer on the table. And because it was about 48 hours or so later, they walked themselves up another, you know, say $5,000. And then because we didn't respond to that, they walked themselves up again another $5,000. And I told my client, I said, if we just sit here and wait long enough, they're just going to walk themselves up to list price, which is pretty much what it ended up being accepted under contract for. Time is your best negotiating tool that you have, whether you're a buyer or a seller, because this could have flipped the other way where the seller could have been really motivated and anxious to get this sold and ended up chasing back the buyer, telling their agent, go back. I don't want to lose this buyer. We really want this sold. Tell them we'll take this offer. So time is your best negotiating tool.
And what's the longest amount of time you've negotiated an offer on a property using time as a negotiating tool?
Oh, I've waited a month.
Oh, I've done 8 months.
Oh, good. You've beat me on that.
By 800%. Time is a very good negotiating tool, and I understand that professional real estate negotiators and professional real estate people know this. So if you're not getting a response in a timely fashion, chances are they're trying to use time as a negotiating tool. So don't fall for it, and make sure you can use time as well as your negotiating tool. And if you are a professional real estate investor, the other thing you remove is the component of emotion, which is why these people kept going up and up and up and up, because there was so much emotion involved from the purchaser's side that they removed all their leverage and kept raising their offer, even though there was no need to do that to begin with. If they just sat tight, and they'd probably do okay. But in this particular case, you got a brand new agent that was probably pressuring them because he wanted to close the deal on his property, presumably.
Yeah, and anxious to get a sale contract, too. So, you know, just be patient. Don't be jumping up, you know, $5,000, $10,000 typically is what we end up seeing. Just be patient. Walk through the process, and hopefully you do have a professional that will kind of hold the reins a little bit, which I do with my clients, whether I'm on the buyer or seller side. You know, I know they just want to jump, but I'm, you know, let's just pump the brakes a little bit here.
Selling a house in a commercially zoned area is the next topic, and this is a very, very difficult thing to price. And normally I would just say call an appraiser and get it done, especially if there's a lack of comparables. But in a lot of these cases where you have a house in a commercially viable or zoned area, you almost have to have a conversation with whoever does the planning in that area, whether it's the town, city, or the province, to figure out what you can do. Because if you're going to rip that house down and put an apartment building in, you may want to know, is it good for 12 units? Is it good for 24 units? Is it good for 24 units with a parking lot underneath it? How much parking do we need per unit? Do we need one parking spot per unit or 1.5 or 2, depending on where you are? It's really important if you're trying to maximize the value of the property that you know what potential it has for whatever is most viable on that spot. In this case, it would have been an apartment building.
Yeah, because it's going to affect the value of like what your return is.
Because the developer is going to look at it. What's my cost per door? Right? If it's $100,000 and you can put 10 units in, then your cost per door is $10,000. Whereas you can only put 2 units in, your cost is $50,000, which changes the whole financial picture.
Yes. And just because there's currently a residential property, if the seller is not aware and the realtor involved maybe perhaps isn't knowledgeable in this area, they just may come in and price it as a residential property, which is doing a disservice to the seller.
Have you run across any cases where the purchaser's agent or the purchasers, either directly or indirectly through the purchaser's agent, became argumentative, dismayed, pissed off with you as a listing agent because of the results they were getting from the vendor?
It doesn't happen often, but yes, sometimes emotions, like we said before, emotions can get high. And if this is a personal purchase, or you're dealing with someone who's not a professional, yeah, they may, but it doesn't happen often.
I recently had a situation where I was selling a property and the vendors told me, we don't care if this ever sells. It's been on the market for years. I don't need the money. And the only offer we're looking at is a non-conditional offer, cash. That's it. Anything else comes in, we're going to reject it. This message was conveyed to the purchaser's agent, which was ultimately conveyed to the purchaser, and she was not very happy that she couldn't negotiate because in North America, of course, as we know, it doesn't matter what somebody is asking. We feel that we have to get it for less, right?
Yeah, they have to feel like they've gotten some sort of deal. Bragging rights to friends.
No, absolutely. And that's why I told the vendor what we should do is raise the price by 10 or 20%. And then we can give a discount to whoever wants to buy down the road, because that's going to be their mentality. They're going to think, I just like going to a store and they say regularly $1,000 for this knife set. And I've seen this on sale for $199. Well, you know, it was never on for $1,000.
Yes.
Even though the retail laws, I believe, say that it has to be. So they might put it on for $1,000 for a week, not sell any units, and then discount it by $800. So it sounds like it's a great deal, even though the week before it was on for $149. Same sort of thing with this. We're at a time of the year, looking out the windshield here, and the grass is still green, but there is a touch of brown. The leaves are just starting to turn. If I want to sell my house in March or January, February, what should I be doing today?
You should be contacting your realtor and getting your marketing material started. In fact, I have just done that this week. I know we have a property listing, Michael, that you haven't seen yet that is going to be coming onto the market in probably about a month or so's time. They're still working away on a few projects, but I've already sent our photographer out and he was able to capture some really nice photos this past week because it's been beautiful and sunny. Well, the beginning part of the week was. So yes, I would be, and I do, collect your marketing material now. You'll be the only one in January with pictures of green grass and looking like the property is showing in its best season and its best light.
Of course, you're going to get some people that are going to say, well, if I do that, then people are going to look at it and say, well, this property's been on the market forever because the grass is green. When I weigh both, I think not so much. You can state the pictures were taken in September.
But our MLS system does say days on market. If it's only been on the market a week and there's no past history of this being on the market previously, just because somebody smartly planned and prepared for this, you know, good for them.
Oh, I've done this in the past. I've had really, really, really good results because everyone has this mentality, take it off in the fall, put it on in the spring. But if we go on early spring or even in the winter, January through March, April, we end up capturing a much bigger audience that's just desperate to buy something to use it when May or June rolls around.
And your pictures are going to pop. Your listing is going to pop, which would potentially get you a better offer when they're looking at, you know, another property, maybe similar features that they're interested in, but they have no idea what it looks like without the white blanket of snow.
And in addition to pictures and video, what I always do is I ask the vendors for a list of those things that are emotional, those things that offer lifestyle changes when they came to the island. I want them to list those things that attracted them to the property because no one sees the property in a better light than the current owner. So when I'm writing the description, it's great to have on hand those highlights of the property so I can decommoditize that otherwise boring house in the middle of the country, in the middle of nowhere, that doesn't really have any advantages over the house down the street. And now I can turn it into this amazing picture describing maybe there's a pond where they go fishing, there's walking trails, there's cross-country ski trails, they've got access to the rails to trails, they've got access to the main highway that's paved, the snowplow hits their road before it hits anybody else, the road's maintained, the beautiful mature trees, the list goes on and on. Maybe there's a waterfall in the back yard, there's a small creek and a permanent rainbow on the other yard. These are the things you can use in addition to your pictures and video. So when you go on in the spring, your listing is going to blow the buyers away.
Yeah. And it, you mentioned a really good point because today they may feel they've outgrown it. It's too small or there's a divorce or they're downsizing. So they're looking at all the negative points about the property, which is why they're moving in the first place. Bringing them back to why they bought it in the first place would help them perhaps provide some really good selling features, things that could be easily overlooked. Because if you were drawn and attracted to this property, we're looking for somebody who sees the same benefits to living in that home. So that's a really good point.
Our next subject I was really apprehensive about having on this podcast, because this podcast is really meant for real estate agents, albeit there are agents listening, which is great, and they're certainly welcome. Patty, what do you have to share with us? Which might be an advantage to buyers and sellers, too, to know the technology behind the agents.
We get paid based on a commission or a flat rate. We don't get paid typically until the property sells. And perhaps some agents aren't able to articulate or convey this because we take for granted what we do every day. We just assume everybody knows this is part of everyone's business. So what I wanted to just mention today is our little golden nugget at the end, depending on, you know, what your background is. If you're a real estate agent, you might be curious about this. And if you're a buyer or seller, you might want to know, well, why should I pay my realtor the fees that I'm paying? Well, these are the things that we have as part of our business and the things that we need to learn and know. Some of the tools that we use is electronic signature programs. We have to learn how to use those, set them up, and be able to actually explain them as well to our clients so that they can use them. We need some sort of social media presence. So social media is another tool that we use to do our business. Whether we're representing a buyer and trying to put out there that we have a buyer looking for this kind of property, if you haven't listed your property or if you're considering, please feel, you know, reach out to your agent and let them know that you've seen it. So it is definitely a tool. Video conferencing. Now, I know I do this quite a few times throughout the year. If I have buyers that are going to be looking at properties on PEI, I use video conferencing to qualify, begin to build a rapport. I can share my screen. We can look at the MLS listings. We can come up with a plan. I also use it for if I'm doing a video showing, FaceTime, there's plenty of platforms for that. We do lock boxes. So these are an expense. These are things to keep a property secure that we have to have in our inventory. We need some sort of cloud storage system. to keep all these files so they're not just sitting on our computer. And perhaps if our computer dies one day, we've just lost all our files. So some sort of cloud storage, a CRM, which is a contact relationship management system. I would say less than half of the agents actually use or have a CRM. This is such a powerful tool. I cannot imagine not doing my business with the CRM. It lets me know who I'm to contact, when I'm to contact, checklists, when I'm supposed to send off emails, notifying them of electricity hookups and things such as that. We need some sort of transaction management system. Typically, I use my CRM, but there are others that you can, you know, spreadsheets and stuff to just be able to manage the process. So these are just some ideas. We also have security, cybersecurity. Everything that your realtor has real estate information on is all to be password protected. So our password logs should be password protected. Our phones, our computers, nothing is supposed to be easily accessible by anybody. Everything for our business is to be locked up and secured. So just to give you a bit of an idea, these are the tools. These all come with a cost. These all help us do our business better and help us serve our clients better.
And that's probably a very small percentage of the tools that we use on a daily basis that are more specific to the PEI real estate market, including the mapping tools and tax computers and accessing IRAC databases and so on and so forth. Well covered. I really appreciate everyone tuning into the podcast here today. If you have any questions about Prince Edward Island real estate or PEI in general, Patty and I would love to share our over 40 years of experience in the PEI real estate market and thousands of transactions handled. We'd like to know what you would like to hear on the podcast. So just text it or email or give us a phone call. Make sure you subscribe or follow the podcast. If this is something you're interested in, give us a review and a star rating. We would greatly appreciate that to motivate us to create more and more of these episodes. Patty?
Yeah, it's great when we get asked questions because that's what people want to know. So feel free to, you know, drop your questions, drop us a line. We would love to be able to have a great discussion conversation. And again, this is all just unscripted. Michael and I, we love doing this. We have real conversations about real topics that are affecting real people every day.
Thanks, and have a great day, everyone.
Have a great day.